If you're going to use your sexual identity to punch right, you're a leftist. Sexualized patronage. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is the only extant political organization which can control the country. Basil is saying, lock them up. The left tries to monopolize the language of empathy and humanity. It's only a mask over the most inhuman, degrading thing. These people are sick. These people are evil. I'm an anti-left Marxist. A libertarian is just another, is a fancy word for a pervert.
This is Illegitimate Scholar, and I'm here with Basil, Neobactrian, on Twitter. So you are a gay, Muslim, far-right cultural commentator.
Whoa. Well, we're already starting off on a bad foot. Let's just make one thing clear. Gay is not real. No one is gay. Sexual identities aren't real, just like gender identities aren't real. But I've been known to, you know, frequent a bathhouse back in before my Volcel days. But yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay,
to make
a
long story short, yeah.
Back in Constantinople, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Or freaking, yeah, it'd be perfect. All right. Well, I'm excited for this conversation today because, you know, you have a lot of takes that I agree with. You've been on the Good Old Boys. You've been on other shows that everyone that's listening is familiar with. So we're going to talk about all those topics. We're going to go into some of your background, Afghani. Wait, is it Afghan or Afghani? Which one's a rug?
Afghani is the rug and the money. We're Afghan.
So you are Afghan ethnically, obviously born and grew up in the U.S., and we're going to have a lot of talk about. Bear Bactrian, is there anything you want to start with? Is there anything you want to tell us?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I guess the most important thing right off the top is check out Bear Bactrian on Patreon. Season 2 is up there on Patreon. Season 1's already up there on YouTube. You could check that out. You could see me be almost 100 pounds heavier than I currently am.
Good job.
Thank you. I skimmed Bronze Age Mindset one time and I immediately lost 100 pounds. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. That's so crazy. That's so funny you say that because, like, early plug, I'm getting in with a guy. I just had a meeting with him an hour before we did this. First official sponsor of the podcast is a guy who does, like, basically culturally informed workout plans, culturally and personally informed workout plans.
The whole mainstream culture in 2024 is catching up to where the online Twitter discourse was in 2018, 2019. And that's why you see, like, the dark Brandon memes from, like, this is exactly how we designed it. And you also see, like, the same cast of characters now featured in Vogue. It's like, it's all 2018 Twitter now.
Hell yeah. Love it.
This is exactly how we designed it. And you also see, like, the same cast of characters now featured in Vogue. It's like, it's all 2018 Twitter now.
Hell yeah. Love it. What do you want to dive into first?
I was going to say, like, listen, I'm sitting my brown ass down and letting the white man take charge as is proper and correct in this dynamic. But whatever you want to do, you want to delve into, like, some more of, like, Basil as a take seller, you want to get right into some cultural anthropology, you want to get into some, I could do it all. I'm backflips and tricks, baby.
Let's start chronologically for both of us. So I want to start with something that would be an inherently good conversation that would give value, but also goes into your background a little bit. So let's talk about, you're an ex-leftist, right?
Right. I was just about to say, that's actually perfect. So where Basil comes from, right, is so basically even to this day, I'll sometimes still, like, call myself an anti-left Marxist, whatever. The important part is the anti-left part. The Marxist is just the way it's a holdover, right? So I came onto the internet in, like, 2019-ish, in where the cultural milieu online was this type of thing that was derided by leftists as the quote-unquote post-left, which where you saw, like, these types of, like, figures on the populist right and the populist left trying to make overtures to each other in this kind of before in the lead up to the 2020 election. And I was listening to these certain, you know, constellation of media actors in this sphere, and I just noticed that
do you have some names, like,
oh yeah, so I was listening to the Good Old Boys, I was listening to Amy Therese from What's Left, I was listening to Red Scare, I wasn't really listening to Caribbean Rhythms, but I was aware of BAP, etc. All of these people were, like, in this derisively called the post-left era. And I was like listening to them. I was like, wow, you guys have this huge blind spot when it comes to the expansion of the Civil Rights Act censorship regime, when it comes to something that I like to call the TQ. So I just noticed, it's like, why is it that you have, because really what drew those people together was like a constellation of like, of shared assumptions, right? The shared assumptions being like, Trump was the harm reduction candidate, COVID was a psyop, things like that, like things, you know, all of broadly those types of populist positions.
And then the blind spot was what?
Was their position on the trainee, the transformer question.
Right, right, right. The Transformers, the Decepticons, the words we can't say.
Right. Exactly. So they were still dealing with it with this kind of like leftist shibboleth in their head where they're like, that's culture war. That's culture war. And I was there trying to say like, no, they teach working people's children in schools that they could be born in the wrong body. This is a direct reflection of the coalition between tech and finance and pharma. These are material conditions. Like at this time, I was like calling myself an anti-left Marxist. Like, hello, we're doing material analysis here. And I was like, I didn't understand the whole like the difference between the realm of like our professed political ideas and then the selling of our takes on the media market that is Twitter, that goes up to the media market chain all the way up to New York, DC, Los Angeles. I didn't quite understand that at that time. I was just diving in as like a man on a mission with like a message to give these people, like a real public service type of thing. But basically as time went on, I realized like, oh, this is a media take selling market, right? Certain political positions cannot be taken because they frustrate like certain cosmopolitan socializing in this media market. And then I started to develop the whole like bazillion theory of sexlectics, right? Where it's like, to give it like just a sentence, it's like, it's supposed to hearken to the idea of dialectics, you know, like, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, that's great. Dialectics will get you very far. I'm an anti-left Marxist. But if you don't understand the psychosexual social connections between the people who are at the helm of these civic institutions, right, then okay, you will chalk up way too much to the invisible hand of the market that can be understood by understanding, like, who's in whose DMs, who wants to do what with who and how. And it's like, that's like patronage stuff. Patronage, exactly. Shout out good old boys. Exactly. Yeah. Sexualized patronage.
And also like just networks, essentially, right? Like
exactly.
Networks, which and is people, patronage.
And when you draw the attention to this and you don't have like a fully like a drawn out like conception of it, these media actors and these like take sellers and these political actors try to hand wave you and to use a feminized therapy term, try to gaslight you. Like, these are just my friends. What are you talking about? The group chat? What group chat? And it's like, these people made a mistake of like letting me see the sausage, how the sausage is made. And it's like, I'm like, well, baby, I'm gainfully employed elsewhere. This is a hobby for me. So I get to be like, yeah, no, I know X, Y, Z and blah, blah, blah. So long story short, I've now made this transition that many have made from that 2018, 2019 post-left, dissident left media space to now this 2024 dissident right media space that's basically just like downstream of Yarvin and BAP and that we're all like existing in.
That's us.
Yeah,
Charles Haywood's finest soldier right here.
Exactly. And it's like, now I'm like just growing my media take selling thing. I have good takes. People like them.
Okay. Here's what I want to do then. Let's talk about the stuff as much as possible. I'm going to take that chunk. I'm going to put that on the Patreon because I can't put it on YouTube. But let's get that out of the way. So then the rest of it can just be for everybody.
Perfect.
Okay.
This part is about 30 minutes long. We discuss a bunch of different things about sexuality that I'm not comfortable putting out on either the podcast or YouTube. So if you'd like to watch it, find it on the Patreon, which is right now $2 a month. You'll get grandfathered in. There's some other content on there that's not available anywhere else. And all the episodes are early and unedited on the Patreon. If you don't want to subscribe to the Patreon, but still want to help the show, I would really appreciate it if you would like the YouTube video or rate the podcast, whatever's relevant to you, do all that. That means a lot. Let me know what you'd like to see more of or how you feel about the new format and the brand new intro on the Discord or on Twitter. I've really enjoyed this whole conversation. I think it shows throughout. We had a lot of stuff to talk about. And I know that if you're a listener to my podcast, you're going to love it.
I'd love to meet those Taliban guys.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's difficult because usually the spaces are all in Farsi. But also I can show you. I have like pictures and stuff from my trip I can show you. It's good stuff. I swam with them at the Hotel Intercontinental in Kabul.
Dude, that's awesome. No, I mean, yeah. I'd be interested.
They're cool
to see
people. They're cool people.
I'm sure they are, man. I know one of that British guy that goes everywhere. Like he was hanging out.
Yeah, Miles.
Time, yeah. Lord Miles. Right. Right. Yeah. No, like, would they be cool with me as a Marine? Like, would they give a
shit? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Would they like it more? Because to me, I'm like, I look at those guys
and Westerners are treated better than Afghans because of like the public image of it all, because they're like, no, we are fine. Like, trust me, you get, you'd be fine. The only thing is it's more expensive as a Westerner to go because I get to stay at my cousin's and he shows me around and whatever, but you would have to rely on a tour guide and they'll bleed you dry.
Yeah. Just cause I'm a Marine. I don't know if I think I would, like, there's a chance that I would be accused of being a spy and I wouldn't want that.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt it. I mean, unless you're like wearing a tattoo on your forehead that says US Marine.
Well, I have one on my arm.
I mean, wear some traditional clothes and no, like, unless you are going out announcing it, like, hello, as a U.S. Marine, everyone just be like, oh, no, I'm an anthropologist. I'm interested in Central Asia and Afghanistan and all that stuff. And
yeah, no, I wouldn't want to hide it either, because an anthropologist, that's like the perfect cover for a spy, too.
No, I mean, I get that. But no, my two cents is it's probably not as risky as you might think.
Okay. It's been so recent after the war that, like, I assume that, like, it'll become very, over time, it'll become very safe. But, like, you know, I view the Taliban guys as, like, you know, I mean, they've killed some people, I know. But, like, it's, like, you know, we invaded their country. I'm, like, I'm not mad at them.
War is awful. War is a horrible thing. The end of war, the cessation of violence, is always a good thing. Peace is a good thing. Going in peace. Afghans are... We actually, like, a point of pride, a point of national pride, like, the Afghan identity and national identity is, like, derived from an opposition to imperialism. It's really, like, part of, like, a central note of it. But a real huge part of that is, like, the idea of hospitality. Afghans, like, get hard off of the idea of being hospitable to guests. Like, you know, it's like...
Let's talk about... I'm going to use the bathroom when we come
back. And then
back,
we can talk about Afghanistan and stuff. Yeah.
We'll talk about that. Yeah, yeah.
Love that.
But the question I wanted to get to before I forget is really, like, I would view the Taliban guys as, like, you know, like, not like they're kind of my, like, they're my like, they're my contemporary, like, as a Marine, like,
they're good,
like,
old boys. They're good old boys.
Right. Like, I would they view, like, do you think that Taliban fighters would also view at this point U.S. Marines as, like, oh, we're the same. We're like,
you're the army but now the war is, it's like, you know how, like, during World War II when they had the little intermission for Christmas and they played soccer or whatever on the ice? It's very much that. It's like, we were defending our country, you are invading the country, whatever, the war is over, you know. I can't do an Afghan accent, it always ends up redounding to a Persian accent, but you get the point.
It's okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, another place I'd really like to go to that I'm afraid to go
for sure
to. I'll be right back.
I didn't understand that. It's like, oh no, you need to, like, be like, hairspray is your friend. I was like, I've really, like, leaned into my Jersey Girl era where it's like, I keep, like, that bag on me. If you, like, open up my jacket, I have, like, a little tiny bottle of hairspray. I'm like, like,
oh, hell yeah. 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 I use, I sometimes use, pomade.
Yeah.
But I use, like, I use, like, Ulta, like, I use, like, salon shampoo and leave-in conditioner. It's the best. And my hair is, you know, aesthetics matter, man. Aesthetics matter. Let's talk more Afghan culture. Let's talk about that. So, yeah, we were talking about Taliban. Like, you're in some spaces with the Taliban. You're Afghan ethnically, and you've been there a few times, and you met some of these Taliban guys. So tell me whatever you want about Afghan culture, man.
So, I mean, like, the first time that it was, like, really, like, being in an Afghan in a Twitter space with the Taliban and stuff like that was actually Samira Khan was doing spaces. Yeah, during the whole, like, Andrew Tate stuff, where she was, like, trying to get, like, these Taliban members in talking about Andrew Tate, and it got written up in Newsweek and stuff like that. But even then, that was post me going there.
How do the Taliban guys feel about Andrew Tate?
The thing is, like, they would come in, but, like, we have heard of this. We don't really care. We're trying to, like, you know, it's like, they don't, like, but it was just, like, a gimmick.
The country here, guys.
Yeah. It was just a gimmick to get, like, more eyes on the space, which was, like, totally fine. Like, that's how Twitter works. But, yeah, no, I mean, people get confused when they see someone like me, which is this is my rhetorical strength. This is the whole point of like being one of the good ones, where it's like they see someone like me, a cosmopolitan, American born, whatever, degenerate. But then when I say with my whole chest, the cessation of war is good. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is the only extant political organization which can control the country. Say what you will. Afghanistan is a Muslim country. I am Muslim. I want my country to be a Muslim country, et cetera, et cetera. It really confounds these people. They don't understand, especially after like 20 years of. Well, fundamentally, you have to understand that the occupation of Afghanistan is the same thing that it serves the same function that the current war in Ukraine or any other foreign policy thing objective is, that besides an containment strategy for the enemies of the NATO alliance, right? China, Russia, Iran, despite other than wanting to have bases on their borders, fundamentally, like what it is in terms of money is like funneling money from the tax base of the West to the defense industry, right? It's just, you send the money from the tax base here to Afghanistan. Sure, some of it is used to prop up a fake middle class of like NGO employed human rights activists and translators, quote unquote, just like useless eaters.
Afghan patronage system that's not effective and has no legitimacy with the local people.
Exactly. It's a puppet regime. And this is why I always take umbrage when people try to describe the puppet regime of the past 20 years as corrupt, as though it's like it could be anything other than corrupt. A foreign installed puppet regime is by its very nature a corruption. It only exists so long as the money keeps flowing. And that's why you read in the Seeger reports and stuff like that of them like leaving duffel bags and plastic bags of money on the doorstep of Hamid Karzai and stuff like that. It's because it doesn't exist without the patronage system keeping it going. And right. Many of these people who got their pockets filled during these 20 years don't understand it because they're too low IQ, or cannot accept it in the way that like a fish cannot understand water, cannot understand their role and complicity of like that process. So they will talk in terms of like liberal platitudes about the rights of women or education or democracy. And none of that obvious, like it should not be a revelation to you in 2024 that none of those things actually mean anything. When a Western liberal talks about democracy, they mean the same thing here that they mean in Afghanistan. They mean a sinecure patronage system for the NGO, their foot soldiers. I mean, in terms of like the ability to address grievances to the government, having a government that represents the will of the governed, et cetera, et cetera. Afghanistan under the Taliban is much more democratic than it ever was over the past 20 years. I mean, the government reflects the will of the people. There's no bribes. There's no graft. There's development out the wazoo. There's no death of thousands of people every week in order to prop up this regime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's something that I'll mention is that, you know, in the bazillion jargon, whatever, right? There is no right wing, right? The right wing and the left wing are just both two sides of the bourgeois political kayfabe, et cetera, et cetera. I describe the left as that coalition that represents tech, defense, pharma, finance, right? As the extant in power Bonapartist coalition that is in power. There are small pockets here and there of people doing anti-left work. For example, like Chris Rufo doing anti-DEI work in the university spaces, for whatever criticism you may have of him, like, oh, you got rid of the black one just to replace it with a Jewish one, and you're actually still bolstering like Jewish lobby censorship, whatever. Those are legitimate criticisms. But still, that anti-DEI aspect of it, because it's all one thing, is still an anti-left action, right? And there are pockets of that, whether they exist here or there or anywhere. But there's no actual extant counterbalance to the power, the political coalition that's in power that we all call the left, right? But that being said, it's like the GAE, which is exactly what was the government of the puppet regime in Afghanistan, especially after 2012. So there's a whole first era of the occupation under Hamid Karzai, in which they really brought in these warlords and these, you know, pederasts and whatever, whatever. And the thing is, it's like, it's not their pederasty that makes them the problem. Perfect example to highlight what I mean there. I can rail lines all day at a party, right? If someone I don't like, I find out did a bump at a party, you know what I'm going to say? You're a cokehead. You're a this, okay? It's not the fact that they're pederast. It's just a nice, it's just a nice visceral thing to be like, oh, the warlords that we recruited in order to prop up the puppet regime that we installed were a bunch of pederast. And it's like, after 2012, you saw the same thing in Afghanistan that you saw here. I used to call Kabul the furthest east DSA outpost, the Democratic Socialist of America outpost.
Yeah.
Because even in America, it was in Obama's second term that we saw a real heavy pivot towards wokeism.
Saw this in the media, which is key. People talk about this 2012-2013 date. When you see there's a graph that I don't have ready, but it goes straight up like a hockey stick. Mentions of racism and other things. It was the response to the fallout from the 2008 financial crisis. And in Barack Obama's second term, there was a consolidation of power within him and his own patronage network that has continued to today, by the way. Barack Obama, in a lot of ways, is the most powerful person in the country, even today, I would
say. Oh, absolutely. And it's because it's like this weird type of like, it's hard to describe because it's like there is the tangible material patronage system, right? But it's buttressed and held up by the ideological underpinnings that the actual participants in this patronage system are true believers in. So it's like they really do view Obama as his personage as a type of like symbol for, I always say the liberal is they say like, you know, religiosity is down in the West or whatever. No, liberals are just as religious as anyone else, except they worship the abstraction of the disabled black bussy seller in a wig and a wheelchair that lives in their mind that they're not allowed. That's the shibboleth. You know, you can call muzzies this and, you know, call white people that, but God forbid you offend their godhead personified as like Obama, Beyonce, tranny in a wheelchair.
Right,
you know?
Right. 100%. Yeah. And Obama himself is a perfect personal reflection of that because he's like, he is on the surface, and Kamala Harris is as well, because like, so I've gone into this before. I've gone into like the demographics of like an Ivy League school. Like, yeah, there's a certain amount of white people, but most of the white people are legacy admins. And then it's like, yeah, they have a good percentage of black people, but a heavily disproportionate amount of those black people are actually very privileged Jamaican and African immigrants that come from the upper class in those countries rather than native African-American blacks. And if you talk to African-American blacks, and when I say African-American blacks, I'm referring to the descendants of freed slaves.
Foundational black Americans, as Tariq Nasheed would call them.
Foundational black Americans. Right. I'm using the anthropological term. The term that they use in anthropology is just African-American. That's the ethnicity. As opposed to like African American just meaning black, because like, you know, counterintuitively, a African who moves to America, neither them nor their children are African American in this sense. It's
right.
It refers to that, but I digress.
And that's why they mog, and that's why they mog on these you know, post Great Society degradate. Listen, if you go back to the archive, let's go back to the archives. Pull up the footage, go back to the 50s and look at these black communities in California, whatever, who were talking about the great migration of these blacks from the South and how they would talk about, like, because they were trying to, because in a pre-Civil Rights Act era, there is only the rational actor that everyone is approximating, right? Post-Civil Rights era, there is now a legally recognized different category of black TM, which now has its own cultural needs, right? Oh, African-American vernacular English, Afro-American hair, Afro-American affectation, our culture, our mammy culture, all of that that only exists after you create an alternative for all of them to try to funnel themselves into, where if you look at the public debates among black Americans pre-Civil Rights Act context, they were trying to assimilate, you know, they were trying to assimilate into broader American culture. And it's it's for that reason that now 50, 60 years later, their grandchildren are illiterate, listening to some half Dominican rapper's name, Cardi B, talking about her wet ass pussy, unable to read. And that's why. But some immigrant who comes here from Ghana, their daughter is a diversity hire at the medical institute. Their son is a diversity hire at the law institute. And it's like, that is precisely why that keeps happening.
And they have, and like the immigrants, they have a different cultural underpinning that isn't this created, victimized Black community. Because honestly, look, by any metric, I haven't gone into the specifics on the podcast before. Regardless of what you think about it, I'm not saying that I don't like the idea of integration. I have many Black friends that I love, but Black people as a people and individually on average were much better off before integration.
And the Blacks will tell you this themselves.
Right, right.
You know, that's the thing. And listen, you've never met anti-Black until you've met a Caribbean or West African immigrant to this country. You have never heard the type of disparagement of foundational Black Americans, as Tariq Nasheed would call them, until you've heard these communities, because
it's acceptable as well. It's acceptable for them to say these things. It's not acceptable for me, and it's less acceptable for you. You have a little bit more cred than me being gay and Afghan.
Exactly.
Like, I can't. This
is why it's so important to me personally, as with my goals being anti-leftism, right? Putting my own race play fetishes aside, I am white men's strongest soldier. I will say with my whole chest what we all know to be true, but they cannot say. I despair for my white friends, my normal white friends, because it's like they can't. They're afraid. They self-censor. They shrink themselves. It's like the intro to that Beyonce song with that, like, that Black anthropologist lady who's like, we teach women to shrink themselves. It's like, we really teach normal straight white men to shrink themselves and not be able to say these things. And that's why it's like, baby, put it on my shoulders. I'll say the slurs. I mean, yeah. We don't have to say the slurs. It's fun to me, but I will at least say that, like, oh, who does the crime? Why are we doing the crime? Why can't we say certain things? Oh, the Civil Rights Act, disparate impact, things like that. You know, it's like, you know, but we're not racist. I love a bleaching moment. I love interracial couples. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I don't have I always say, like, it's not a mixed marriage if you're both Catholic. Like, who cares? Like, it's not.
So true. No. So true.
Yeah.
And I always say, too, it's like, because I'm Muslim, I always say, like, racist, because sometimes. This is a huge problem I run into many times with Muslims, is that they don't understand how politics works, right? So when I say things that may be perceived in 2024 as racist, they'll try to admonish me by saying, brother, racism is not good. And I respond to them, I say, of course not. Racism is haram. But the ascribing a value to people based on their race, ethnicity, skin tone, whatever, goes both ways. I refuse to worship at the altar of the Black trans bussy seller, which means having to smash certain shibboleths. If that means in little ways of being like, oh, I like this rap song, I'm going to publicly sing along to every word of this rap song. That's one thing. If it means that I'm going to counter signal in any way that I can the St. George riots, and I'm going to be like, oh yeah, George Floyd was a fent addict, white beater, whatever, like, I'll put my knee on his neck myself, then that's necessary. And that's not racist. It's halal, as I sip my martini. Dude,
awesome. Awesome. Yeah, that's hilarious, man. This is great. Okay. So, oh, man, there's a couple of things I don't know why I didn't write them down. I was just like, I was just watching you go off. yeah. So Obama,
I'm always glad to be here to be entertaining. You know, that's what I do. That's what I live for.
I'm sure there's plenty of people listening to this right now that are laughing their asses off as well. So, dude, Barack Obama is like the perfect like face for all of this because, like, okay, he's Black. You can say that, right? But he went to an Ivy League school. He's half Black, so it's like woke one drop rule, and that half Black is African. It's not like, you know, I'm sympathetic, and I've said this sometimes, and I've gotten heat from the right for this. I'm sympathetic to the idea, and I agree with basically the idea that Black Americans, as a result of slavery, although also as a result of more so, I think, the way that integration kind of destroyed their progress in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like, they have problems stemming from that. There are problems that stem from that because, like, they don't have the underpinning of, like, of ground up culture of creating things because, and it's not their fault, it's because they were forced into a situation where that type of, where like the type of like industriousness was not incentivized. So it didn't become a cultural value over hundreds of years. And that screws a culture up long-term. It does. I think more recently, basically because it's more recent, the Civil Rights Act and has done way more damage to Black people than good. And they were getting better. They weren't the best. There's a bunch of reasons for that, but that it put a hole in it. And one of the things I point to is the fact that Black kids used to go to school with Black teachers. And that matters. That matters in a lot of ways. And you know, I'm actually an ex-teacher. I got teaching certified, never got a job, but I quit my teaching program. And like, that's a real thing. Some of the stuff that they talk about is wrong. And a lot of it is like this model minority. Like the racism of low expectations is huge in schools for Black kids and for other kids. And it's because of this Black TM thing that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. No, the Black community in America is like, has for 150 years been the liberal subject of the liberal focus of social engineering to their detriment. You know, it's like, this is like playing with the incentives of a culture and a community to such an extent that, like, look at what you created for them. And it's truly like, it was something I've talked about on my podcast too, where it's like the left tries to monopolize the language of empathy and humanity, right? But truly, it's only a mask over the most inhuman, degrading things. And I was talking about in the context of like homelessness and drug addiction and stuff like that, where they talk about, like, you know, managed decline and all of this stuff. And it's like, it's a managed decline of society. But if you think about the right, sure, they may use slurs. Sure, they may talk about IQ points and this and crime and et cetera, et cetera. But fundamentally, it's because it stems from an expectation that you should have been able to reach your human potential. But for whatever reason, maybe the right misattributes the reasons. Many of them don't. Many of them are very high IQ and will, despite their playing on the timeline with slurs and whatever, which I love, you know, maybe it may not make that so clear, but fundamentally it comes from a more pro-human, pro-social type of thing, where it's like, with the context that I was talking about, I was like, yeah, the right will say, you know, clean up the streets, round up the junkies, whatever, but that is a more human, pro-social impetus than, oh, let's just give them somewhere to shoot up and die in peace. You know, it's like, it's this complete pervert. And that's like truly the definition of evil in my sense. It's where it's like a complete twisting of reality and language and like an inversion of the morality. And it's like, that's why I'm like, these people are sick. These people are evil.
Yeah, for real. And it's like, it's just because it's hidden behind like euphemisms, and they love euphemisms. They love words that like say something, but they say it in a nicer way. Which I hate. Like, it's, you know, whatever you call it, it affects people's perception of it, but it doesn't affect the reality. And it does seem to me in a lot of ways, like a lot of these criminals, like, okay, here's one thing. Like, you talk about the FBI crime stats. Oh, 13% of the population commits 50% of the murders. But that, like, if you take that
3.5%,
right. It's like, if you take that, like, most of the victims of that are other Black people. And it's like, those are the victims. A lot of those victims, most of those victims are like other people can like being involved in crime. But then there's a lot of them that are just innocent bystanders. There's many, many cases of children, elderly people, normal people just going to do their jobs that are Black, but live in this place. And because lawlessness is allowed to like just run rampant, it affects the majority of the people living in this community. They're just trying to do their best. They're not criminals. They're not bad people. And that's the thing that I think the right misattributes. They're like, oh, Black people are a total lost cause. They're stupid, low IQ, criminals. It's in their DNA. No, it's not like that at all. It's just not, because you can look at other Black populations in other places and maybe they have elevated crime rates compared to other populations, but some of that's cultural, whatever. I don't really get into the genetics because I don't care, but they're much, much lower than the American Black population. And you can point to a lot of material reasons for that. And also the fact that like in El Salvador, when they locked up like a few percent of the population, all the crime stopped. I'm sure this, not that I recommend we go to that extreme extent.
Let me put that burden on. You can throw that on me, sir. Basil is saying lock them up. No, but yeah, I mean, well, this is what, because what it gets into is like,
you would help black people the most with that. Yeah. And then, yeah, going to whatever. But yeah,
because the thing is, it's like so often on the right and on the left, what happens is when we talk about these things, we get into like a type of like utopian trading where you say like Muslims will do, in my caliphate, you know, or my right wing friends will be like in my white ethno state, in my Hyperborea, or the lefts will be like after the revolution, we'll do that. Not really, you know, we could talk about utopia trading all we want, you know. Yeah, well, I'll make my Tora Bora goon cave and all my right-wing bodybuilder homies will come and enjoy the bleach bunnies as they do their belly dancing performances. Like, yeah, let's trade utopias. But fundamentally, it's like in the real world, right, no person would come up to me born and raised in America sipping my martini blah 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 and say that I'm not American, right? I understand. I will tell my listen, baby, I'll go back. I understand. We're setting back 20 million. I'll go back. I get it. Okay. But fundamentally, it's like, even if I go back, right? Foundational black Americans, as Tariq Nasheed would call them, are part of the American nation in the Marxist sense. As America as a nation, you got to deal. Even if you want your white ethno state, even if you want, you know, South Africa had electricity up until before the current situation. If you have to deal with the fact that these people live here and they are part of your American nation and they are your destinies are intertwined with them. You cannot do Liberia again in 2024. I mean, you could try, some people will go, whatever, but
yeah,
tens of millions will have to be accommodated in this American nation.
Right. Right. Like, you got to do something. And like, it's so what I often argue for, like, as far as I'm concerned, and this is so weird because we're going in the opposite direction of this, especially because like I was, or I am a certified social studies teacher. So like government is like what like you teach, and it just, they're encouraging and this is in Connecticut, but it's at like, I went to the same education college as the federal secretary of education, who's a complete woke. Like I know what the top, like it's a top 10 education college. Like it's one of the best. It's just the University of Connecticut, but for whatever reason it has the best. And like, they encourage, like the name of the peak of education in the whole country right now is culturally relevant or culturally affirming pedagogy. And this is a tool of disunity for the country. It's encouraging different belief systems to coexist, and that inevitably creates tension. It doesn't make any sense to have a country, like, because then it's not a country, it's not a culture if you're not assimilating people together. Then it's just a collection. It's an economic zone, I guess.
It's an empire.
It is an empire.
It treats America as a strip mall, et cetera, et cetera. And fundamentally, what it goes back to is kind of what we've been talking about this whole time, where it's like the issue is we don't have freedom of association. White people want freedom of association. Black people want freedom of association. But white people's freedom of association at this point is coded as terrorism. And black people's freedom of association is adopted into the mainstream lawfare of the left against its enemies, in such that it's like promoting black-owned businesses and promoting women-owned businesses and blah, 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 and getting preferential government contracts, et cetera, et cetera. So black freedom of association is preferred and prioritized, where anyone else's freedom of association, white people's being the important aspect here, is literally treated as terrorism. You cannot do it without butting up against and crossing over the line of becoming an official state enemy.
Right, right. And it's legally, I mean, they integrated at the point of a gun, right?
Like, very,
it's
like very, very literally. Look at the pictures. They have a bayonet at their and you know who? Ruth Bader Ginsburg's burning in hell because she did this. What I wanted to say earlier, because when we were talking about the Civil Rights Act, it's like Ann Coulter, love Ann Coulter, she seems like she'd be fun at a party. she's always been on this tip with the Civil Rights Act, where it's like the Civil Rights Act, when it was passed, was meant to address the legacy of slavery. And it's deeply American. It's part of what is this nation's history, right? Black people, Black Americans being part of the American nation. And what the issue then became when the Civil Rights Act was expanded to include all racial minorities, right? That was the first expansion. The next expansion was the Ruth Bader Ginsburg's expanding it to capital W women TM. That expanding it beyond that to sexual identities and the whole, you know, all of the Ellen and all of that stuff, expanding it to people with disability identities, people expanding it to people now with gender identities. And
it's like 75% of the population at this point.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's because once it creates material incentives for someone who has those either behavioral or biological reference, right? If you have like the ethnicity to rely on, or even if you don't, if you're Elizabeth Warren, or you have the behavioral history of like being a faggot, then you can now adopt, you can make reference to this legal system and then get all kinds of benefits. You get a Small Business Administration loan, you get a preferential hiring, you get disadvantaged firing, all of these things. And it really is the elephant in the room, really, that we all end up dancing around. And it's like so much of any issue that pops up can refer back to it. So it's like when I want to talk about the TQ, last year when I wanted to talk about the TQ, all of it ended up being about Drag Queen Story Hour, which isn't in and of itself a level abstracted from the material legalistic lawfare question of the expansion of the Civil Rights Act, right? But then once you make it abstracted to talk about the drag queen story hour of it all, you then give space, it gives this gray area to people who may posit themselves or purport themselves to be anti-left to then run cover for the left by being like, oh, you're obsessed with, why can't you be cosmopolitan and cool and chill? It's like, that's not the point. That's actually why it's actually so very important for Basil as a take selling whatever to grab my martini glass and go party with trannies who are all Jewish in New York City and be like, baby, I'm as cosmopolitan and cool and chill and suck and do it all the rest like the rest of them. However, my cool trans friends don't get upset when I say, hey baby, she, her, this, that, you look cunt, the house down, boost, yet's mama god, but you shouldn't be allowed to change your driver's license from male to female. You're cool with that, right? Okay, cool, so we're all good. But they want to cloud it in this ick of you're not cool, you're not chill, you're not cosmopolitan or cultured or whatever. It's like, baby, I've read all the books that you read, I've seen all the movies you've seen, I'm just committed to anti-leftism, and I can still be cool and fun, but I'm not going to run cover for the left the way that you are.
Hell yeah, dude. Hell yeah. I love it. I absolutely love it.
We need people. I'm sorry. I mean, I hate to say it because it just sounds like I'm promoting my own brand, but it's like, you'll need people like me. I'm sorry. I can't. Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. It is what it is. I hate that it has to be this way, that it's like, I have this stupid metaphysical rhetorical power that my cool, straight, normal, white friends don't have. But guess what? I'm articulate and I'm able to do it. And so I put the team on my back happily.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the thing is the reason that like there isn't very many of people like you is because being like you is disincentivized. Because like by expressing the beliefs that you express, regardless of your status of like your perceived identity by other people and how they might view that as being sacred, you lose the benefits that you would get by expressing the things that you express. So like, it's very easy. Like I encourage my Black friends, if I'm talking to my Black friends, I'm like, hey, like this is like, you can feel however you want about the greater thing. Use the affirmative action as an individual, use it. Okay. Definitely use it. And like most of them think it's stupid. Especially the ones that I talk to, but I tell them like, look, I get it. I get how you feel. Like everyone has disadvantages and advantages in life. Use them. But like with you, you're gay, you're Muslim. You like, you know, I identify however you want. and you're Afghan at that. Like you're heavily like an ultimate victim. And even though I would view you as white and you are like Caucasoid racially, like, yeah, oh my God, we're just two, we're just two long haired Yom Yaya guys just chilling here.
Yeah, no, but that messes up my whole race play thing. So it's like, no, I go back to being a cave monkey. Sorry.
Got it. Yeah. I love talking to a Puerto Rican who's telling me that they're like that they're like, oh my God, like I'm a POC. It's like, listen, your ancestors massacred the Tainao Native Americans. Like your ancestors were literally conquistadors. I'm a third generation Irish person. Shut up. I'm not listening to your
bullshit. My barber is a Puerto Rican who looks so white, right? Looks so white, but like says the N-word all the time. And I'm like, what's going on here? But then like every time I go there, the smoke detector beeps every 30 seconds. I was like, never mind. You honestly got me beat on the POC card. My smoke detector doesn't beep like that. So you got it. You know, like
100%. he's definitely black.
No, but it's true because like I could if I was more cynical, if I was less committed to the actual political whatever that I'm committed to, I could just easily be like the greatest homo con, you know, the one of those LGB without the T homo cons.
You'd be hanging out with Blair White, like
exactly. I could be Blair White, where it's like, yeah, we'll signal against the excesses of the trans question, but we'll end up reifying the premises, which were the sexual identities of 10 years ago, because this is more anti-left Marxism. The left and the right are just two sides of liberalism, one being the vanguard and one being the rear guard, where now you see the quote unquote right represented by Blair White, Caitlyn Jenner, whatever. They are the rear guard who have shored up the gains of the vanguard from 20 years ago. So they're the ones who are like, LGB without the T. We need the cool trans people like Blair White and Caitlyn Jenner. Baby, you're just doing rear guardism. I'm an anti-leftist. You know, it's like, but if I was cynical, I could go do that. Or I could go be one of those like based blacks who like will be like, oh yeah, look at all this, that, and the other thing, but don't bring up the FBI statistics. And it's like, if you're going to use your racial identity to punch right, you're a leftist. If you're going to use your sexual identity to punch right, you're a leftist. If you're going to use your gender, you know, so it's like, I don't care if you cross dress. I don't care if you men. I don't care if you're from sub-Saharan Africa, but if you're going to punch right using any of those, innate markers by weaponizing a politicized identity on top of it, then we are not doing the same thing. And that's why you're one of the bad ones and I'm one of the good ones.
Nice. I agree with that, man, because it's like, it's right and left. They are innately terms that are relative. So if you're punching right, then you are a leftist from the perspective of them, maybe. But like, you know, it's and I've come around to this recently, like the no enemies on the right thing, because of the way I look at it, it's like the left, they make excuses for Antifa all the time.
It's like, the thing is, it's like, so, because the thing is, it's like, I'm constantly like on the timeline, I come off as much more mean and autistic and spurgy on the timeline than I am. And like, people will read the time. And this is why I like having these kinds of conversations, because I can like reference to something I've said and like be able to draw it out in a way that's like, but yeah, no, it goes back to being like a Marxist or whatever. It's like, yes, these right and left are right and left of liberalism, right? It's like it's they're relative to each other in this, and this is why I call people like Mitch McConnell and Dan Crenshaw and all these anti-Trump Republicans, I call them GOP leftists, because as a Marxist, you understand that both bourgeois political parties are just vehicles to power, both liberal vehicles to power. The whole left, the whole Democratic Party is leftist, right? Okay, in this sense of what we define the
cultural
left
sense,
but it's like much of the Republican Party are also advancing the interests of tech defense, pharma, and finance, and insofar that they're doing that, that is leftism, baby.
Right.
Like, it
right,
doesn't
right.
really matter. Yeah. And that's, it was, you know what it was? It was, he was saying something where it was like, the right will say stuff. I'm just like, I'm still like in the back of my head, like trying to like pull back.
Was it like,
whatever.
Like left, the left makes excuses for Antifa, but the right will like attack.
Right. No enemies to my right. Exactly. Yes. No enemies. That's a great point. A great example of this, right, is the difference between right-wing racism and left-wing racism. The left-wing racism being obviously anti-white hatred based in the Civil Rights Act, based in DEI, all of that stuff. When I see someone to my right, ostensibly, using slurs and saying TND and all of that stuff, that type of quote-unquote racism is benign. It is so far removed from the levers of power. When I see someone punch right by calling those people racist or talking about white supremacy or whatever, you are parroting and strengthening the rhetorical justification for the regime in power. And it's not even just the race. Regime, yeah. Exactly. And that's why that type of racism is malignant and is actually dangerous. And it's the same thing you'll see so much of what we see on the timeline, where it's like gender discourse. All people want to do on the timeline is gender discourse. How body count and divorce and sluts and whores and OnlyFans and this and that. The 19th Amendment, all of that stuff. There's a difference rhetorically between men who hate women, who hate the whores and who hate OnlyFans or whatever, and the people like, I don't know if you're familiar with the account Radfem Hitler, who do, or the Radfems generally, who do man-hating, because the incel types who hate women, quote-unquote, are removed from the levers of power. The edgy Radfem types who say like, oh, I'm Radfem Hitler, you know, it's like, oh, you, but what you're doing is bolstering the anti-male Me Too levers of legitimating narrative of those in power. It's not the same. And this is why it's like, it goes into my race play take too, because it's like the same people who do that on the race stuff, lo and behold, it's usually because of like a dissonance between their internalized psychosexual desires and the anti-white political sphere that we currently live under.
They're always married to white people. They're always married to white people.
Exactly.
It's like every single time. They're especially because, and that's a thing. It's like, look, in the traditional sense, in like the, like, I'm not going to, like, America was a white supremacist country. I mean, originally it was like an Anglo country. Then it was like a Northern European supremacist country. Then it was a, like, going into the late 1800s. We're really going into the, like, the early to mid 20th
century. Yeah, up until the Civil Rights Act. That's when we flipped it on its head.
Right, we're right. So, like, we'll say, like, because you have to carry in, like, assimilation of Italians and Irish and the other periphery, which happens around World War II, which is later than people realize. But, like, we'll say the 1940s to the 60s is really the white supremacist time, but earlier was more of this. So they're like, if you're somebody who is a person of color, in the sense that I shouldn't even use the term because it's framing.
You're a colored person.
If you're a non-white and you're a power seeking individual, then number one, what you're going to do is you're going to latch on to all of the power that you can gain through your own ethnicity and through your other identities. Number two, you're going to marry a white because you're searching for the power, and then you get the best of both worlds and your kids get the best of both worlds. Because if you're a non-white and you move yourself up in power using your identities as like as a hammer to like to get yourself into positions that are prestigious and give you a high amount of income, and then you marry a white person, you have children with a white person who's already in the established power. Because, like, look, there's plenty of 50-year-olds right now that are like, oh, I'm a white guy, but I'll be anti-white, whatever. I already have my job. It's like it's Gen Z and millennial white guys that get screwed over. It doesn't screw them over, you know, regardless. But what happened, they get married, their kids now have the support of like the probably good genetics, because like that is a factor, not for just between races, but within races. Then you have the actual like resources, and you have the cultural know-how, and your kids, because of the woke one drop rule, because their mother is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is probably 80% white, her 10% white children that are married to like that, and she's married to a white guy, maybe Jewish, I don't know. So even more access to networks, your kids are just totally set up. And it's a new multiracial globalist it's a new multiracial globalist, like freaking 1890s level robber baron class.
Go to any elite elementary school in Manhattan and you will understand what I mean when the ruling class is Ashkenazi Hapa. That is the ruling class, is like their children are Hapa Ashkenazi. Like, but no, it's absolutely so true. And it's like, this is why the phenomenon of the Kami hijabi happens, right? The woke Middle Eastern South Asian girl who trans women or women hates white men, throws on a hijab because it's like, because they are navigating. Why is that? When is that useful? It's useful when you're navigating lib dominated institutions like academia, yes, and anywhere with an HR department, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's exactly what you said. It's like, it's to assimilate into white culture is a marker of status, always has been. If you watch 90 Day Fiance, if you watch like a Swaylu and whatever, her dad is always like, marry a white man, don't marry a Samoan, because of that same thing where it's like, I want you to assimilate into the culture. However, because the current political climate is so anti-white, right, they cannot reconcile this innate, first of all, everybody wants the BWC. It is what it is. But they cannot openly say it the way that I can as one of the good ones, where it's like, baby, you got a BWC, hit the DMs. So what it has to filter itself through being deranged on the timeline. The take, the bazillion race play take is thus. It is all bourgeois political kayfabe boils down to projected race play fetishes. The degree to which one's own race play fetish is unaddressed is directly proportional to the degree in which they are deranged on the timeline. So when you see a female of color saying, talking about white supremacy or land back or kill whitey or this or that or colonize or this or that, see, can I get a breakdown of their sexual partners by race, please? It hits every single time, because that innate striverism of the PMC aspirant POC has to be filtered, because fundamentally these are strivers. It's what's going to come out of their mouth is going to be whatever is regime approved, has to come out in this, like, still psychosexually obsessed with BWC, but comes out as kill whitey, the colonizer, blah, 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 my husband's family is so racist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And listen, I originally made a name for myself a little bit with the TQ stuff, but the race play stuff in 2024, listen, if you are a white man who enjoys a little bit of bleaching, this is your year, baby. This is the year for you. This is the year of bleaching. This is it. If you're a mid white man, go to a DSA decolonized caucus, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel, baby. Like, you can take home anybody you want.
Wow. Okay. So if you're into the ethnics and you are a mediocre white man, that's what Basil says that you should do. And I think he's probably right. My audience is heavily religious and skews towards their 40s.
My apologies for being a degenerate.
No. You're totally good. I'm sure they also lean heavily libertarian in a lot of ways. So,
libertarian guy with Asian wife. You guys love this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Libertarian guy with Central Asian wife.
It's funny you bring that up. That's actually Jack Lloyd, who is a libertarian guy that has been, he's been fighting with my side of the Libertarian Party recently. But regardless, that's funny.
Well, because you said libertarian twice. The basal libertarian take. I'm always going back to race play. The basal libertarian take is that libertarians, as a rule, obviously exceptions to the rule always apply. Libertarians are typically end up being the left's most useful idiots, because libertarians, fundamentally, libertarianism is capital L liberalism, right? So. Yeah. They will decry all of the excess. This is also another basal TM, is critique the excesses, reify the premises, and you'll see it in all types of manners, where they'll be like, someone will say like, oh wow, the GameStop transformer saying it's ma'am, that's crazy, but that has nothing to do with Blair White. You know what I'm saying? So they're critiquing the excesses, right, but reifying the premise that we all have gender identities. I'm cis. He's straight. So the whole point is to reject the premise's root and stem. But libertarians always fall into this thing where they end up whenever, because the thing is, if you're anti-left, right? Like I said before, there is no extant organized political organization that is counter to the left, right? But if you're doing anti-left politics, necessarily you're going to be in coalition with religious conservatives. You yourself don't have to be a religious conservative. Right. Case in point, see me at the bathhouse. But I'm never going to counter signal against the religious conservative. So, for example, right. when Dobbs got overturned, I was not going to be like, oh my God, this is going to hand the Democrats a thing because they're going to be able to rally on this and whatever, 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 because I know that the anti-left coalition necessarily includes Christian evangelicals who, whatever our disagreements may be, are religious conservatives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So very often you'll see the libertarian, because I always say that a libertarian is just another, is a fancy word for a pervert. I make a joke where I'm like, every time a teenage boy gets walked in on by his parents jerking off but doesn't stop and stares him dead in the face, a libertarian is bored, because it really comes down to like they don't want to be told publicly that like their sexual proclivities need to be kept private. Like, listen, I don't care what you do, I just don't want it but it's like the libertarian takes this as the greatest offense.
Yeah. So I have disavowed libertarianism personally, some of my friends not entirely, but yeah, this is the root of where this comes from. I also want to say a BWC, for those that might not know, is a big white rooster.
We love our poultry out here. We love our poultry.
Awesome. All right.
It's actually like a memorabilia from my law school that like I have to hide the logo from.
Oh, like, you're a lawyer too?
Yeah, that's the gainfully employed part.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Also explains the two things. It explains like, part of being good at take selling is like being able to draw analogies and like explain them succinctly and like cutting out the fat. So like that's like part of it. That's like lawyering helps. And then like the focus on the law, you know, and it's like that's why it's like so many people like to, especially in the beginning, like to like dismiss me as being upset because like they wanted to like, say like the TQ stuff was all culture war, that you were obsessed with culture war distraction for a long time. That's what they wanted to say. And I'm like, I'm talking about the Civil Rights Act. I'm talking about Bostock. I'm talking about Obergefell. I'm talking like culture war. Like, and that's the thing. It's like they want to make it culture war because this is what the left always does. The left, think about AOC crying at the fence all those years ago.
Yes. Crying, oh my God. Those fake photos. It's right. Performative. Exactly. Surface level.
It removes political questions, the political question of immigration. It removes it from the realm of political discourse to the realm of emotional discourse, where we're no longer talking about the benefits or the merits of XYZ political position. It becomes, you're a bad person if you're on the opposite side of this political. Yeah. And the crypto leftist, the post leftist, the more advanced leftist does this similarly, where if they're able to trade on a type of cultural cachet of being cool and sophisticated, what they'll do is they'll remove these political questions from the realm of the political to the realm of the cultural, where instead of talking about the merits of the political whatever we're talking about, we're then talking about what's cool TM versus what's cringe TM. Oh, you're not cool, whatever.
Anti-left Marxism, what does that mean? I think I know what it means, but just anti-left Marxist. That's how you identify? Right. You said that's your identity?
I mean, sometimes. The more important part is the anti-left part, but the reason I say Marxist still is because fundamentally, like, the way I view politics and political economy and the way I view anything that's happening is still very much informed by a Marxist materialist analysis. And even so, it's like when I first came on in that whole post-left era, I was trying to highlight the distinction between like what we call the left, what I described earlier, you know, as this coalition for tech, defense, pharma, finance, POC, PMC, aspirants, lump and shock troops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And trying to highlight the distinction between what that type of utopian socialism, as Engels might call it, versus the scientific materialism, scientific Marxism of, you know, class struggle, synthesis, whatever, right. Hegelian, whatever.
Let me just get into this, because, like, you know, for a lot of the audience, the phrase Marxism is just a dirty word. It has a lot of baggage to it. So, like, my take on this is that, and honestly, like I've said before on the podcast publicly, like economically, I'm very much like left wing, like leaning towards Marxism. Like right on the other side, I'm like not like Marxism in the sense that like I'm not a communist, but like all these words. Okay, the point is that these words themselves are social constructs, and like Marx. But an important thing to understand is that Marx wasn't breaking down the doors of the Romanovs. Marx was a philosopher. He wrote about things. He didn't give a lot of like recommendations on actions taking. That's like what other people did.
That's Lenin. That's what Lenin did.
Right. And a lot of people say Marxist-Leninism. So there's actually in Marx's ideas, and I want to get into them right now, like materialism. I would love for you to tell me and the audience what you think materialism is. Or what materialism is to you, like just describe it. I'm a little bit familiar with it, and I generally am a big fan of it in this in a way of understanding the world. So materialism.
So the way I'll approach it is to say that it's to piggyback off what you said. It's that Marx did not make many prescriptions of what is to be done. That's literally a book that Lenin wrote. Okay. Marx was the greatest contemporary describer of capitalism as a system, an economic system, right? If you want to understand how capitalism worked from its inception with like the Ricardo and all that stuff and out of mercantilism into industrial capitalism.
And this is like 1800s when he writes.
Yeah,
this, right?
1800s. It's like that. There's no better describer of it. Like, go find someone like David Harvey who describes what Marx was talking about, and you will understand what capitalism actually is. Not in this type of like moralizing advocacy for the proletariat, but simply just understanding how, you know, the how labor and value and these things work. The problem
labor is, theory of value is one of his big ideas.
Exactly. But the thing is that labor theory of value doesn't really work in the contemporary era, because post-Cold War, there's only one. I mean, it's changing now with this era of multipolarity that some people might call. But like from the post-war era through the end of the Cold War, the West has, because of the dollar being the reserve currency and the United States owning the money printing machine, it kind of throws a lot of that out of whack.
No, wait a minute. So what is the labor theory of value and also materialism? But like, can you do it simply?
I mean, I'm not as good a Marxist as I am a Muslim, but you know, it's the idea of I'm just going to use buzzwords because really it doesn't really matter what the ideas are, but the idea of overproduction, the idea of surplus value, take like what you selling your labor on the market does, the idea of the proletarian only having his labor to sell, the idea of the capitalist by definition only able to extract profit by the fact that what he pays you is less than what you produce. All of this stuff, like I said, is thrown kind of out the window in the contemporary post-Cold War era because we live in a financialized world.
Right.
However, the idea of a Hegelian political analysis in which where you focus on what are the material political coalitions that exist, whose interests are represented.
People and this is don't... like patronage. This is like
patronage. Yes, very much like
materialism
patronage.
Materialism is very similar to patronage. It's like the real, it's the real stuff behind all the theory and smoke and mirrors.
The liberal will
this
take...
is Marxist. Technically.
Yes,
this is Marxist.
The liberal will take what someone says at face value. The Marxist, the illiberal, will say that I don't really care what mystification is coming out of your mouth to justify it. I understand that the ruling coalition is between these certain industries and that they're the political, if they capture the state, the state's actions benefit the. So,
right.
The best way to understand the current moment that we're in is if you have just a very cursory understanding of dialectical materialism, basically just being like, you know, where are the centers of power, where are the civic institutions, where does the money go, who is support, like where is the mass of working people supporting XYZ, blah 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 blah. Read the 18th Brumiere of Louis Bonaparte. It's a very short read, and he's describing a certain moment in France in which there's a crisis in capitalism. Okay, there's a crisis of overproduction, which is similar to the crisis that we saw in 2008. What he describes there is the factions of capital that were properly positioned to do it, seizing the state through Louis Bonaparte, the Emperor Louis Bonaparte, and beating down the factions of capital outside of their coalition. So to draw it to the current contemporary, right? When I describe the left as the beneficiaries of tech, defense, pharma, finance, when the 2007-2008 financial crisis happened, those were the most strongly situated sectors of the economy. So when Obama became president, who was he funded? He was funded by the finance industry, the tech industry, the defense industry, the pharmaceutical industry. So during that whole recovery era, what it was those industries through the Democratic Party and through Barack Obama beating down the other factions of capital. This is like an intra-class conflict, right? What they want is a cessation of the crisis. Who's on the outside of that coalition? If tech, defense, pharma, finance are on the inside, on the outside of it are industries like manufacturing, oil and gas. And that starts to illuminate itself when you see things like, global supply chains, that hurts manufacturing, but that doesn't affect tech, defense, pharma, finance. Green energy, that hurts oil and gas, but that doesn't affect tech, defense, pharma, finance. So they want, fundamentally, if you want my prediction for 30 to 40 to 50 years out, what they want with this whole transformer stuff is they want to prime in the populace the idea that their body is not themselves, right? So that if your genitalia isn't yourself, maybe your arm isn't yourself, maybe your body isn't yourself. So they're priming the public to maybe in a generation from now or two generations from now, having a deep, my prediction is that the way that they really view this crisis settling itself is through depopulation, but in the type of way where they convince you that you can be uploaded to the cloud, so that people line up to be uploaded. They see their loved one's body plop, but they see a facsimile of their loved one chucking and jiving like a Tupac hologram at Coachella, and they say, oh no, my loved one is there. But guess what? Now we don't have this useless sector of the, because we don't need a proletariat anymore. We have AI and we have the third world mass immigration of service industry workers who are never going to rise up against you. So it's that's the Marxism stuff is just how I view it. The anti-left stuff is how it's effectuated. It has to be I don't care if you're a religious conservative. I don't care if you hate commies. As long as we are attacking the coalition that forced me to get the thing in my shoulder and stay inside for the forever flu, then we're on the same team. And that political coalition that we're against is tech, defense, pharma, finance.
Wow. Yeah, no, that is awesome. That's terrific. I actually think it's so good that I think we should end right there. So yeah, is there anything you want to plug? Your Patreon, right? Patreon,
right. Season 2. So yes, you can follow me on Twitter at Neobactrian. I have a podcast called Bear Bactrian, the first season of which I love it.
Nice.
I love it. Okay. The first season is available on YouTube. I look very fat. Please don't judge me. I've lost a bunch of weight. But the second and third season, we're now full swing into the third season. The Good Old Boys will be on next week, or this week actually, is on Patreon. There's a couple free episodes up there. There's I think 3 free episodes from season 2. But yeah, it's good stuff. Bazillion Thought is going mainstream in 2024. Race Play, Sexlectics, the TQ. It's the year for Basil Enjoyers. So jump on the train. It's only $5 a month. Oh, and also I'll just say it's $5 a month for the Patreon, but I do accept, as an alternative payment plan, I do accept nut vids in the DMs with the sound up, and you get the RSS feed for free. So I'm for the people. I'm for the people.
Got it. Awesome. Okay. That's the Marxist in you. You're trading. What is it? That's bartering. I think that's bartering for goods and services.
It's just good old fashioned sexlectics, people. You got the BWC. I'm here for you. You get the podcast for free. I'm a libertarian is just another, is a fancy word for a pervert.
Patreon, which is right now $2 a month.